You're listening to a free podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship at www.thersa.org.
Well, aren't you remarkable people? Beautiful sunny day. And here you are, gathered together to discuss a 300-year-old philosopher. So it's very heartening. Will not come to regret your decision, I'm sure, over the next hour. I'm Matthew Todd, I'm Chief Executive of the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this RSA Thursday. It says here we couldn't have a more topical question for discussion, and I suppose in one way it is very topical, another perhaps not quite so topical. And we couldn't have a more qualified pair of commentators to discuss it, because this week marks the philosopher David Hume's 300th birthday. And we plan to discuss why his ideas are still so important and relevant today. And it's my great pleasure to introduce our speakers. Nicholas Phillipson is Honorary Research Fellow in History at Edinburgh and has just published a much-anticipated biography of David Hume. Peter Millikan is Gilbert Raab Fellow of Philosophy at Hertford College, Oxford, and alumni, now you're supposed to be alumni. We had that discussion before, but alumni David Hume Fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at Edinburgh University. So, Nicholas, without further ado, can I ask you to kick off?
Sure, thank you very much. I'm a historian, as Matthew has said, and so my take on Hume is a historian's take, and I have, the take takes three forms, really. I think Hume matters, as far as a historian is concerned, because of his religious scepticism and the extraordinary response that it provoked. I think it matters because Hume, although we like to think of him as a philosopher, actually wrote one of the most extraordinary histories of England. A history of England, which was famed in its day for having achieved the almost impossible of writing impartially about the history of England. And the third take I have on Hume is something to do with the quality of his thinking about human nature, about human society, and about the possibility of making sense of it. And that take is about the historicity of Hume's thinking about human nature and mankind. And I want to just say a little bit about all three of these things. Now, Hume was famous in his own lifetime as being a skeptic, an infidel, an atheist. These words were thrown about endlessly. These were words that were thrown about endlessly with as far as anyone whose religious thinking seemed to be remotely unorthodox. They were terms of abuse, not unlike the sort of abuse that Americans on the right are apt to dish out when they speak of all Europeans as socialists. It's designed to generate more heat than light. But the point about Hume's scepticism is that Hume's scepticism means very, very much more than this, and it was taken by the more thoughtful of his contemporaries for what we now know it is, one of the most dangerous and profound forms of philosophical scepticism we have. Hume was interested in his first book, his Treatise of Human Nature, in the first volume of it, 1739, he was interested in the traditional claim, a claim which is almost as old as philosophy, that we have been endowed with the capacity for rational, for reasoning, which will furnish us, if we use it properly, with knowledge about the world, about the natural world, about the supernatural world, and about our place within it. Hume was interested in this traditional claim, and his scepticism arises out of the way in which he challenges this claim. We may talk about how he did it, the technology of it, if you like, later on. But Hume found reason to dismiss this claim altogether. He found there was no ground for believing that reason had the power to organize the mind, to furnish us with these different orders of knowledge. Instead, he concluded, the dynamic power which drives the workings of what we like to think of as the mind is in fact the imagination. The organizing principle of what we like to think of as the mind is in fact custom, habit, convention. The sort of experience, the cognitive experience, the moral experience we acquire from everyday life in society in which we move. This was a claim which had the effect of undermining the truth value of any system of knowledge which claimed to be founded upon reason. Any system of knowledge. But the one system of knowledge that really mattered in all of this was religion. And what matters, and what makes Hume a world historical figure in this respect, is that this was understood by his most intelligent and most perceptive religious Christian readers. And what matters in world historical terms is their response. Largely for the immediate generation, from Hume's fellow Scot, Thomas Reid, at Aberdeen, and much more potently and powerfully in Königsberg from Immanuel Kant. Two philosophers who realized that the foundations of knowledge had been gravely shaken, and much more than that, our Christian understanding had been gravely shaken and needed to be rebuilt. What we see, therefore, in world historical terms, is the end of a chapter of in the intellectual history of Europe, with most profound influential consequences for the history of Christian civilization and the intellectual and cultural foundations of Christian civilization. In this respect, Hume's skepticism is one of the milestones between the early modernity and the modernity of the world in which we live. Now, so much for my first point. My second point is one which, as a historian, I've always found absolutely fascinating. Hume starts off life as a philosopher, writes his extraordinary but little read treatise of human nature, develops themes in that in that theory of human nature in the decade after its publication, but then does something which used to shock philosophers to their very, very core. He put down his philosophical pen and turned to the writing of history. And not just the writing of all histories, but the writing of the history of England. It's an exercise. He seems to have... he always says that he'd had such an idea for a very long time. But he begins to do it in the late 1740s. He started by the 1750s, and he will spend the next decade writing a six-volume history of England. It's an odd story, actually. He started with the most modern volumes, the volumes on the history of James I and Charles I, and then went on to the later Jameses and Charleses and ended with the Glorious Revolution of 1688. He then went back to the Tudors, and having gone back from the Tudors, got as far as the beginning of the Tudors, he then went back to the beginning and to the Roman invasion. And as one of his sterner critics said, like the witches, he said his prayers backwards. But this history, now what is interesting about, there are all sorts of things that are interesting about this. In the first place, can anyone think of another philosopher of genius who turns to the business of writing and executing a history of a great history, and I'll explain why I think it's great presently. Not just dabbling in history, but writing a genuinely great history and acknowledged in its time, and I think increasingly now, as a great history. That movement is extraordinary. I think it's unprecedented in the history of early modern and of modern intellectual life in the West. You just don't do it that way. Perhaps scientists do it. Scientists are nowadays are better able to begin lives in one discipline and to achieve greatness in another. In the fields of philosophy, history, and the fields of humanities, much, much more rare, if at all. So the first thing is this fascinating spectacle of the philosopher turned historian. The second thing is that although Hume was slagged off as a sceptic and an infidel, and quite rightly he was a sceptic and he was an infidel and made no secret of it, the interesting thing is his history is greatly admired, even by people who are made to feel uncomfortable by his philosophy. To put it briefly, his history becomes a bestseller by the end of his life. By the end of his life, he's made up about £5,000 out of it, a huge sum of money in 18th century terms. It will remain a bestseller right the way through to the middle of the 19th century. It goes through endless editions, it's published everywhere, it's translated everywhere. It's a sensational commercial success, and indeed it is also, in contemporary terms, a sensational historiographical success, because Hume was seen to have done for English history what had proved to be impossible. That is to say, to write an impartial history which was untarnished by party political wrangling. The previous history of the writing of the history of England, then and in many ways now, is the stranglehold with which political ideology can get bound in to writing about the fabric of the development of any political society. Hume's greatness for contemporaries was that he'd managed to achieve that level of impartiality. And he did it in a way which gave him a mass readership. The understanding that the story of how the English, I'm leaving the Scots out of this deliberately, of how the English set out to try and understand the development of their own history at a time at which English history, England itself, was being transformed by war, commerce, empire, and moving into civilizational territories completely unknown to it. Hume's history belongs in the cultural history of this response of English society to these extraordinary changes that are taking place in the English state. And that leads me to my final point. I said I think Hume's history is a great history, and I'm echoing a contemporary view of his history. I think I want to validate that. Because it seems to me that what runs, there are some things about Hume's history which were immediately attractive to people. The narrative is superb by any standards. Hume as a narrative historian is a wonderful historian. His narratives move very fast. They are extraordinarily nuanced, and they're designed, in fact, to expose problems which we may wish to pause on and to develop. And those problems, the order of problems which interested Hume were twofold. One was the problem of how ought we to judge the performance of the rulers of the past. The danger isn't we judge them by the standards of the present. If we're going to judge them by the standards of their own time, what are those standards to be? They must have something to do with the problem of how they managed the political world of their own time, how they understood the constitution and the method and the mode of government of their own time. And this led to the second thing, which, as I say, makes Hume's history immediately interesting to contemporaries, because his lesson to the English was that you do not understand the nature of your constitution now, you do not understand the nature of the history of your constitution. And the general message he developed out of this was to say that the English must realise that their constitution, like any other, is in a state of perpetual flux. And as I say, that it sounds simple to say that, but working that through was, well, these were the things, these were the intellectual handles which contemporaries got onto it. But what is interesting about it is the historicity that's built into this. And I think this is it's a historicity which helps us to understand why a great philosopher who did what Hume did could have turned quite easily to the writing of history. Go back to the skepticism. Hume says all our cognitive skills are in fact acquired skills. We organize it. Ordinary life, from birth to death, teaches us to exercise our various cognitive skills, in order to make sense of the world in which we find ourselves. They are acquired. The message in all of that is that if you want to understand your own mind, it is best to start off with yourself, with actually an autobiographical exercise in looking at the history of your own belief system. Something he did himself. But what you also have to remember is that your own character, your own belief system, is forged at a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular country. And so, in fact, the person who wishes to acquire a general understanding of human nature should start with themselves. They should then move out to the history of the society in which they were born and brought up. But then they should also remember that any society is part of a much wider civilization. And that civilization, which will be shaped, in Hume's view, largely by the means of subsistence and the distribution of property. And where Hume's historicity comes from is this extremely powerful laminated view of human nature and of history as a discipline. It begins philosophically with the self. It moves out to the history of a particular civil society. It moves beyond that to the history of civilization. I want to maintain that this is the peculiar quality which Hume, in fact, that is embedded in the treatise, and which Hume will find himself developing in the rest of his life, and particularly in his history of England.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicholas. You went slightly over time, but I didn't sense...
I sensed that
there might be an outcry if I tried to stop you, so I'll let you go. Peter.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Okay, I want to talk today mainly about why Hume is still of interest, and in particular still of interest to philosophers today. I spend a lot of time writing about Hume, and I quite often get asked questions, even sceptical questions about this, including from my wife, actually. She, you know, if Hume's such a great writer, then surely what he says must be pretty clear. Why are you lot still reading it, you know, hundreds of years later and coming up with new interpretations of all the rest? Isn't that a bit strange? Well, yes, it can seem a bit strange, but I want to explain why we philosophers, and particularly historically minded philosophers, aren't just dinosaurs whose total lack of progress is shown by our continually rehashing the same things. Okay, so first of all, a word about progress in philosophy. It's very easy to cast stones at philosophers and say, look at all these problems that you're addressing, they never get solved. It's not actually true. Philosophers do solve problems, but after the problems are solved, they tend to be taken out of the domain of philosophy, and they're no longer called that anymore. So progress by philosophers, if you look back at the 17th and 18th centuries, there's tons of it. You know, Bacon, Galileo, Descartes, Leibniz, Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, etc. One could go on. Huge strides being made in the political arena, notably, thought about religion, and thought about physical science. Natural philosophers. Of course, we don't now call them natural philosophers. We call them physicists or whatever. But at the time, people were working out how to solve new types of problem. And that's where philosophers come in, where you've got a discipline that is not yet fully formed, where we're not quite sure how to solve the problems or even what the appropriate methods are. And that's where you will find philosophers particularly working. So if you look back at past generations of philosophers, their successes can be found typically in what are now established disciplines. So a lot of Hume's great success, for example, pioneering studies in economics and in psychology, because people in economics and psychology will no longer read Hume, but Hume played a very, very important role in getting those disciplines off the ground. More fundamentally, I think you can see Hume's influence in a huge amount of modern science. And just to take a couple of particularly striking examples, Hume is very keen to emphasize the continuity between humans and the animal world. Charles Darwin was reading Hume at the time he came up with the theory of evolution. But Hume is one of the most frequently cited authors by Darwin in his lists. Einstein credited Hume with the key insight that led him to the special theory of relativity. More generally, the big message that comes out of Hume's philosophy is the empiricist one. That is, a priori, sitting in our armchair, we can't possibly tell how the world works. The only way to find out how things work is by experience and observation. Now, if you look at the progress of modern science, take quantum mechanics, for example, it's clear there that the establishment of quantum mechanics, a theory that seems madly paradoxical in many ways, not possibly a theory that anyone would have come up with just sitting in their armchair as a likely speculation about how the world works, we've been driven to that by hard experimental observation. So I think one can see the progress of modern science as being very much in the Humean spirit. Go back before Hume and people are trying to work out a priori how things are going to work. Of course, Immanuel Kant tried to rescue that from Hume's critique. But in the early 20th century, that gets blown out of the water and science is done very much in a Humean spirit. Okay, you might say again, that battle's been won. Why do we still need to read Hume? Well, Hume still has a lot to offer in areas which are now at the boundaries. For example, cognitive science. There's a new interdisciplinary field. A lot of questions arising about the relation between human thought, artificial intelligence, bringing in linguistics, and computer science, all sorts of different areas coming together. And there are big questions about how things should be addressed there. So just to give one example, Jerry Fodor came out with a book in 2003 in which he appeals to Hume for inspiration in the correct understanding of the human mind. He finds Hume's ideas still extremely fertile. Another point I want to make is one about fashion. Philosophy is quite subject to fashion, and I don't think that's really surprising. If you consider that we are focusing on problems which are very difficult to solve and where even the methods aren't agreed upon, and they're very abstract problems, they're not very tightly tethered to common life. So it is not at all surprising that you get a lot of fashion within philosophical thinking. Now, one of the great virtues of studying, if you like, classic philosophers, great minds of the past, is that it can help you to look with a more realistic perspective, a more detached perspective, at the particular fashions of the day. And Fodor gives an example of this. I mean, he is rebelling against a spirit of holism and pragmatism that largely derives from people like Wittgenstein and Quine. He's looking back to Hume and saying, look, here's a different way of thinking of the mind's contents, more atomistic. We can look at things from this different perspective, and that can inspire us with new thoughts. And another very topical example comes in economics. It's very interesting that economics is an exception to what I was saying earlier about science generally being empirical these days. What our economists have typically done is to use an a priori model of human behaviour based on the assumption that everybody is a rational utility maximiser. I think that is a very pervasive thought. It's as well to be reminded by Hume that it's not necessarily a correct thought. In fact, Hume very nicely refutes it. So let's suppose we take a particular case. There's an earthquake. A nurse volunteers to help the victims of the earthquake. Well, let's suppose it's a female nurse and she's got a male victim, which makes it easier to talk about. So she nurses some chap who's been hurt in the earthquake. Why does she do it? Well, this is the way the a priori thought goes. She must desire this guy's getting better. Okay, so why is she nursing him? Well, it must be because she desires him to get better. So she's actually only doing it in order to satisfy her desire. So actually, she's selfish after all. It's the only reason she's doing this nursing is because she foresees the satisfaction of her desire and the consequent pleasure. Well, this is what Hume says about this kind of reasoning. And he alludes back to Joseph Butler. It has been proved that even the passions commonly esteemed selfish carry the mind beyond self directly to the object. That though the satisfaction of these passions gives us enjoyment, yet the prospect of this enjoyment is not the cause of the passion, but on the contrary, the passion is antecedent to the enjoyment, and without the latter could never possibly exist. So what he's saying is the reason why the nurse gets pleasure when her patient recovers is that she desires the recovery of the patient. If she didn't have that unselfish desire to start with, there would be no pleasure at the end. So the purely rational model of behaviour is getting the cart before the horse. It's completely implausible. The suggestion is that somehow she anticipates getting pleasure from his recovery, even though she doesn't give a damn about him. And then she behaves now in such a way as to maximise that foreseen but completely irrational pleasure. Another very typical line that Hume makes against this. Animals are found susceptible of kindness, both to their own species and to ours. Nor is there, in this case, the least suspicion of disguise or artifice. Shall we account for all their sentiments too, from refined deductions of self-interest? Or if we admit a disinterested benevolence in the inferior species, by what rule of analogy can we refuse it in the superior? Again, very down to earth, we're not as rationally calculating as some people like to think we are. We're clever animals. Now, that, I hope, is a very clear illustration of how going back to Hume's thought can be a corrective even today. There are plenty of people who are subject to the kinds of illusions that Hume and other great philosophers have pricked in the past. So there are things, very important things, we can learn from them. Another point, speaking as a philosopher, philosophy is a difficult subject. When one's trying to make progress, you have to try to think outside the box. That can be a very difficult thing to do, particularly if you're thinking in an area where there's a lot of discussion that's going along particular lines, no doubt moulded by current fashions and so forth. I find going back and looking at Hume, a very ambitious philosopher who's trying to connect lots of different areas together, it forces me to think through what he's saying in my own terms. And this is an important point about why we're constantly reinterpreting the philosophers of the past. I mean, suppose, for example, you take Hume's talk about faculties. He talks a lot about faculties, about what reason does and what the imagination does and so forth. Now, understanding exactly what he means by this is actually quite tricky. One of the reasons it's tricky is that Hume actually is what we call anti-realist about faculties. He doesn't really think that faculty language is describing actual entities. So what is he doing when he talks about faculties? Well, in order to understand what he's doing, I have to try to think myself into his thoughts. But of course, when I think myself into his thoughts, I'm bringing a mind which is partly conditioned by study of modern philosophical logic, computer science, cognitive psychology, and so on. So I'm having to take those 18th century thoughts and, as it were, translate them into my mind. And inevitably, one finds there all sorts of unexpected things. And some of those things will be things that Hume himself was thinking of, and some of them won't. But there's an important role for serendipity here. Sometimes Hume will make a connection, because he's such an ambitious philosopher, trying to connect these different areas. He will say something, and I, in trying to think through what he's saying, will see something, get an idea that I'd never have got otherwise. And this is why I think reading really great minds of the past, and there aren't that many of Hume's calibre, very few, but reading these great minds of the past with their very ambitious, all-embracing thoughts, linking together all these different areas, is still a very enriching thing to do, and actually brings real progress in contemporary philosophy. It's not just an historical exercise. Finally, I mean, I can mention a whole raft of recent philosophers who found a lot of inspiration in Hume. For example, John Mackey, who supervised me a long time ago. Hume's moral theory and his philosophy of religion were very great influences on John Mackey. Peter Strawson, discussing free will and scepticism. David Lewis talks about the Humean mosaic, his general metaphysical picture of the world, which is having a massive influence these days. Annette Beyer has thought a lot about Humean reason and how reason can be interpreted in a way that is social and passionate, not just abstract. And Simon Blackburn, who's professor of philosophy at Cambridge, his entire philosophy has been very much inspired by Hume, applying Humean ideas to moral theory and indeed to metaphysics. I don't think it's a coincidence that Hume is so fruitful. He's really by far the greatest philosopher of the early modern period to have developed a philosophy which is as far as possible independent of religion. So we are now in the business of trying to do things like make sense of morality in a way that does not depend on religion. I don't think it's at all surprising that we find that many of the avenues that Hume was the first to pioneer have proved to be so fruitful, and I think will continue to be so for a long time to come.
Thank you, Peter. Well, that's fantastic. From Nicholas and Peter, we've had presentations based on very deep thinking and research and scholarship. Now I'm going to ask a couple of incredibly superficial questions that require them to go way beyond their academic comfort zone, perhaps, and then we'll open it up. The first question I want to ask is about the debate that's quite live since I think Sam Harris wrote a book quite recently about this, which argues that our understanding, the understanding derived from behavioural sciences and evolution, the way that we understand the cognitive processes involved in our moral judgments, means philosophy is almost an anachronism, or certainly moral philosophy is no longer necessary to explain anything. How do you think Hume would have responded to that idea? Nicholas?
He would have known the literature you're talking about, inside out and outside in, to start with. And I think it is fair to say that Hume, we know, the more we know about Hume, the better informed he was in the natural sciences, to use the 18th century term for this. And a lot of Hume's philosophy is geared to asking questions which can be answered empirically within the constraints of existing science. Now, he never rules out that those constraints will move. What he does want to do, however, the whole time, is to say you can't offer an unsupported check on what might be. He's very cautious about that. And as I say, I think were Hume to start to write the treatise now, it would be in fact, a very different book.
Is it right if I just add something on the topic there? I mean, I think it's a very interesting question. Does cognitive science make philosophy irrelevant? And actually, it focuses very much on an area of philosophy that is of tremendous current interest amongst Hume scholars. And it's this, trying to get some objectivity in there. I mean, the task of moral philosophy isn't just to find out how we react in certain circumstances. It's also to find ways of judging what is good from a more objective point of view. And one of the things that Hume is very keen to do, both in his moral philosophy and in his aesthetics, is to find a kind of objectivity there that comes from the uniformity or intersubjectivity, if you like, of our reactions. So he doesn't want to say aesthetics is just bunk, morality is just bunk. And actually, there are also echoes of this in his epistemology, but it'll probably take too long to go there. But I think very much we can see the problem that we're faced with as the very problem that Hume is addressing. And it's not something that we can just sweep under the carpet, because we do want to carry on making moral judgments, don't we? And we want to aspire, at least, to make them in a way that is at least objective, not in the sense maybe of reflecting the nature of the universe, but at least reflecting the nature of humanity in such a way that we can converse together and agree on them.
Thank you. Can I ask you one other question, which just about Hume the man, which is, and I'll start with you, Peter. What was it that made Hume this amazing figure? Is it just that he was a random genius, as it were? Is it something about his time that made it possible for him to be this amazing figure that Nicholas described? Is it something about his upbringing, indeed, or his influences? What is it that you would say was the thing that made this, which made Hume Hume?
Well, coincidentally, I was giving a talk the weekend before last at the Chirnside Philosophy Festival, which is the place near Berwick where his family lived. And I was speculating that there were particular influences in the Borders then that provoked the line of thought that particularly led him towards causation and concerns about causation, I think linked with debates about free will. So there was a very strong religious element at that time. What I would focus on with Hume, more than anything, I think, is his ruthless honesty, as well as being his very, very sharp logical insight. So he writes in a letter about how he produced a book written before the age of 20 about his struggles with religion. And he says it was a struggle of restless imagination against inclination. He really wanted to believe the traditional story, but he kept coming up with arguments and worries about it, and he worried away at them and dug, and eventually came to the conclusion that the religious beliefs he'd been brought up with were false. So I think that's the character of the man. He won't settle for an easy answer. He's obviously extremely intelligent and insightful, but also ruthlessly honest.
Nicholas, what do you think was it that made Hume Hume?
What made Hume Hume as a philosopher, or what made Hume as an extraordinary presence in Scottish intellectual history? I think there are things that people forget about. Hume is a one-off. No historian could possibly have predicted a genius, a philosophical skeptic, appearing in Scotland. No cultural historian could do that. He's a one-off. But he's a second one-off as well in that particular environment. He was a very nice man. Now, say he'd been a shit and a bastard. Hume talked to everyone. And what is fascinating is if you look at him in his social environment in Scotland, in Edinburgh, people like him, even when they disagree, for the most part. There's an outer penumbra of people who will have nothing to do with him, as you and he perfectly well understood. But he is sociable. And the business of communication, the business of language, the business of, in fact, encouraging a moderation and a reflection in the use of language isn't a million miles away from an account of the sort of social processes and the cognitive processes which are actually being written about. And again, the third thing. Say Hume had done what he threatened to do and up sticks and moved to Paris. He wrote most of his treatise in France. He was a Francophile. The French liked him. All of these things are extraordinary one-offs. The sociable Hume is an interesting figure to start with. As far as the thought is concerned, I agree with Peter. You have to start with religion. You have to start with very, very early worries about the authority, the intellectual authority of the proofs which were being offered him for the being and nature of God. And I think I would add to that one other thing. Skepticism, and a fairly radical form of skepticism, was a well-known discipline in every church in Europe, in every confession, as a way of knocking bright, young, troubled divinity students into shape. You could say, okay, if you're a skeptic, if you don't believe in God, here are all sorts of proofs. And there's some very, very sophisticated skepticism around in Europe in the post-revolution, Reformation era. And what you would do would be that you would work the divinity student over, and you would say, so you believe in nothing, but you exist. I mean, you're going to turn into a crank, you're going to turn into a psychological misfit and all the rest of it. And there is it is quite possible that Hume himself was given a bit of that discipline by his uncle. His father died when he was young. His mother was a delightful woman, but had no claim to being an intellectual at all. His guardian was his uncle, who was a high-flying Presbyterian minister, who Hume clearly didn't like. We don't know. If we wanted a really great archival discovery about Hume, we would find out more about what went on in that local Churnside parish with that uncle. But it is not totally impossible that Hume was introduced to scepticism by an uncle who wanted to show the impossibility of scepticism as a way of not just understanding yourself and the world, but actually of being able to live sanely.
Also, the Churnside Presbytery was involved in the prosecution of a local philosopher called William Dudgeon.
Absolutely.
And it's entirely possible, I think. Dudgeon, one of the key issues there was free will and determinism. And my hunch is that Hume got interested in the notion, the concept of cause and causal necessity, key notion in his treatise, precisely because he thought it would throw light on the key issue that was at stake in that debate. So I think speculation, as Nick says, if only we found some archival.
So what I want to do is take two or three questions from around the room. We'll take them all together and then do your best in the 5 minutes you'll have left to answer them.
I believe I'm right in saying that Hume is a member of Parliament. At some point, it's like, am I wrong? Oh, right.
He was a diplomat.
Yeah. Not a member of Parliament. You've got to ask about his expenses.
With Foreign Office budgets, I don't think so. But I was actually going to ask, it was a question that maybe extrapolated from Matthew's first question about the political philosophy that he might apply to the times that we live in. If thought is disciplined by tradition and there's a strong experiential component to all our a priori, well, what are thought to be a priori, thinking. What would a legitimate political order look like at the moment in terms of the 300 years that he's been dead?
I'm unsure of the dates. Does the Scottish witch mania have any relevance to this?
Yeah, I was interested in where you see the Enlightenment, I'll call it, how that's progressing now, what directions, if any, did it come to a hot stop? I don't know. I expect it's in many directions, so it's a difficult question. And the other thing, of course, is about the resilience of religion, which I think fascinates a lot of people, but particularly me.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because that was the one I was going to ask, but I ran out of time. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Each of us is a child of our time. So isn't there a huge danger about putting any thinker on a pedestal? Hume may be, you know, the sort of patron saint, the hero of analytic philosophy. But for German critical philosophy, I mean, he's a disaster. He's an utter dead loss. You know, I'm thinking of perspectivist, hermeneutic, dialectical, cognitivist, all those sorts of things. I mean, look at Hegel's critique of empiricism. Look at Schiller, look at Simmel, Dilthey, Adorno, the Frankfurt School, all these sorts of people. Peter Milligan said, thinking outside the box, sure. Edmund Burke said, rather interestingly, those who wrestle with us strengthen our nerves, sharpen our skills. Our adversary is our helper. So, I mean, don't we need, I mean, if we're going to understand him in perspective, don't we need to consider his harshest critics and actually look at him in terms of, you know, the modern world, this modern world of meltdown, etc., etc.? You know, there are all these flaws. One doesn't need to list them, the binary thinking, etc., the atomism, the conception of human nature. But what about his harshest critics?
Okay. Nicholas, let's start with you. You can pick from you know, Hume's politics, Scottish witches. the Enlightenment. Maybe take the religious question, which is: would Hume, do you think, have been with Dawkins attacking religion? Would he have been more tolerant towards it? And why are you giving him such a easy time? And there's all these Germans who can't bear him.
Hume would not have approved of Dawkins. I'm absolutely sure about that. Hume does not approve of dogmatists of any sort. And I think we will leave Dawkins at that. Hume on religion is the depth of Hume's discussion of religion is much more profound than a lot of people realise. It is not just simply the attack on claims made by theologians about reason in the treatise. It's Hume on the shaping of popular religious belief. He's fascinated and has to be fascinated in the importance of religion in shaping the political mind as well as the spiritual mind, and he is appalled by the continuation of the way in which religion and politics were tied up, and in which religious belief, political beliefs, political ideologies had become hopelessly enmeshed in his own time. Hume, I think you need to think of Hume as someone who had an abiding interest in the pathology of belief. Beliefs of all sorts. Where do they come from? Then, and are these beliefs which are likely to generate what he calls superstition and enthusiasm, in which case they may well be dangerous in public terms, or are they just privately held beliefs, which are fine, don't do anyone any harm, so just leave them be. Witches are in probably on the stage. Witches, they've just about got round to stopping burning witches by Hume's day, the 1690s, the last burnings, and again in the 1690s, some overzealous Glasgow ministers tried to have a go at witches, and they were stopped. An unfortunate graduate student was hung for blasphemy in 1696. If I remember.
January.
In 1697, for blasphemy, quite rightly, because he was a blasphemer of a very public sort, and carelessly the government had forgotten to repeal the statute. Hume and his critics.
Yeah, these pesky Germans.
Well, I'm going to take on them.
Yeah, you're
going to do the judge. All I was going to say is occasionally the most extraordinary claims are made nowadays about what philosophers say and stand for. Adam Smith is a key example of this. The things that economists make Adam Smith say now are bizarre. And in fact, I do think it is interesting, as far as a historian is concerned, just try and remind people periodically, not just of what Hume or anyone else thought about this or that, but to remind people of the shape of the philosophical enterprise in which they were engaged, and to remind people that that when you're dealing with the very greatest of philosophers, these enterprises are usually pretty tightly constructed, and that, critically speaking, in using them now, I think it behoves philosophers to remember that they extract plums, or what they think are plums, out of a tightly constructed system, when they may not be extracting anything like that at all.
Great. I'm going to ask you to deal with the Germans, but I'm also sometimes I have heard in the past people claim Hume as a figure of the right, in the sense that he was clearly part of the Whig Enlightenment rather than the radical Enlightenment. Do you think that that is something that we can credibly argue, or is that to rip him out of his context?
Okay. First of all, on that, I don't think there's a simple answer. He clearly has a considerable belief in, if you like, evolved institutions, and he's no fan of revolution. But on the other hand, if you take his ideas seriously, on all sorts of things, including, for example, property, as an artificial virtue, you would find that it actually has quite radical implications. I don't think, exactly as Nick said, I mean, people like to see Smith and Hume as apostles of the right, and people who are fond of Smith's economics conveniently forget that he wrote a book on the theory of moral sentiments. I'm a believer in looking at the whole philosopher. I said before that I think part of the great value of studying philosophy historically is to look at the big picture. It's by looking at the big picture, by trying to understand them, not just picking plums out, that one sees these very fertile links, and one comes to understand all sorts of things better. But that involves arguing with them. So you don't just put them on a pedestal. When I'm trying to think through Hume's thoughts, it's not that I'm sitting down at his feet trying to work out what I should believe. Not at all. I'm arguing with it, and trying to understand where he's right and where he's wrong. And there are plenty of places where he gets things wrong. But he's a clever enough man that you can learn a lot even from that. I find it funny that he's thought of as a patron saint of analytic philosophy. I mean, Hume was, whatever else he wasn't an ordinary language philosopher or a logical logic shopper, you know. If he's a patron saint of analytic philosophy, he's a patron saint of a lot else too. He's a very broad philosopher. I'm not going to take on Hegel right now.
you've got a minute.
But if Hegel could write with the clarity and beauty that Hume can, he'd be a darn sight more worth reading.
Yeah.
Can I just finish with one thing on the resilience of religion, something that was brought up? There's a lovely a wonderful letter by Adam Smith written after Hume died. And one of the things he says in this letter, he explains how Hume, on his deathbed, dying from cancer, knowing he was dying, was joking about what he might say to Charon the boatman in Hades as an excuse for staying longer. And he says, good Charon, I'm working on a new edition of my works. Please let me stay until I finished it. And Charon says, once you've done that, you'll be wanting another edition, and so on. Good Charon, I hope to see the downfall of some of the prevailing systems of religion. To which Charon replies, that will not happen these many hundred years. Get into the boat, you lazy, loitering rogue. So this is Hume, as reported by Smith. I think Hume was well aware that religion was going to last a long time after he did. But I think many of the worst forms of religion, the more dogmatic and aggressive forms, have been severely curtailed, and Hume has played a very major role in doing so. Of course, there are parts of the world where that's not true. Those are parts of the world where Hume is not read.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. We have to end the session now. Doing this job, the Chief Executive of the RSA, is an absolute, pure, undiluted pleasure, and the last hour has been one of those occasions. So can you please join me in thanking Nicholas Phillipson and Peter Millingham.
If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app and access video and audio files on the go? You can find our app at www.thersa.org.